Your polite enthusiasm represents lost minutes of their day. Crompton answered Holz's call as if he'd just been talking about the ear that moment, had possibly been talking about the ear for years. And this unexpected welcome call was a natural continuation of an ongoing conversation in the Crompton household. Crompton was born in Nova Scotia, and looks like the kind of tall, lean, honest-faced rancher John Wayne would have trusted in one of his westerns. He's got a slightly odd, breathless way of speaking. Never hesitant, just brief, confident declarations that could use a little more air. Holz wanted to know if Crompton remembered any old suspects who stood out and should be re-examined. He did, and unenthusiastically fed Holz some names. Crompton's real wish, it turned out, was for Holz to follow up on an old hunch of his that the bosses had prevented him from pursuing at the time. Jurisdictional cooperation is spotty at best now, but was downright dismal back in the late 1970s. Police teletype and the gossip mill were the only ways cops heard about cases in other agencies. The ear disappeared from the East Bay in the summer of 1979. Crompton's bosses nearly danced with relief. Crompton was panicked. He could tell the guy was escalating, that he was requiring more terror in his victim's eyes to get off. His threats about killing his victims, previously stilted in manner, were more severe but also looser, like someone shedding his inhibitions. Crompton worried. Inhibition shedding was not what the ear needed. In early 1980, Crompton got a call from Jim Bevins, a Sacramento sheriff's investigator he'd become close to through their work on the ear task force. Bevins was trying to step away from the case. Its hold over him broke up his marriage. But he wanted to tell Crompton that he was hearing rumors that Santa Barbara had a couple of cases, one a homicide, that felt like the ear. Crompton called down there. They stonewalled. Nothing like that here, he was told. Several months later, at a statewide training conference, Crompton was seated by chance next to a Santa Barbara County Sheriff's investigator. Small talk ensued. Crompton played dumb, pretended he wanted to talk shop. What about that double homicide not too long ago? He asked. He never let his face reveal the chill he felt as he listened to the details. I'm telling you, Paul, Crompton said. Call down south. Start with Santa Barbara. I heard there was something like 5 bodies down there. I will, Holz promised. I know it's him, Crompton said, and hung up. 20 years later, Holz called Santa Barbara and got shut down, too. The sheriff's department denied having any cases that resembled what he was talking about. But near the end of the conversation, the detective on the other end either recalled something or had a change of heart about obfuscating. Try Irvine, he said. They have something like that, I think. Holz's call to Irvine led him to the Orange County Sheriff's Department, which put him in touch with criminalist Mary Hong at the crime lab. Holz explained that he'd recently developed a DNA profile for an unidentified white male known as the East Area Rapist, or EAR, who'd committed 50 sexual assaults in Northern California from 1976 to 1979. EAR investigators always suspected he'd headed south and committed more crimes there. Holz rattled off a quick description of his M.O. Middle to upper middle class single-story homes. Nighttime home invasions. Sleeping couples, binding, female raped, occasional theft, mostly personalized jewelry that meant something to victim over more valuable items. Ski mask made physical identification difficult, but evidence indicated a size 9 shoe, blood type A, non-secretor. Sounds a lot like our cases, Hong said. At the time Holz and Hong talked, their labs were using different DNA typing techniques, OC being an early adopter of STR typing. They could compare one gene, DQA1, which matched, but that's all they had to compare. The Contra Costa lab also wasn't CODIS eligible yet, meaning they couldn't link into the state or national databases. Hong and Holz agreed to keep in touch and update each other when the Contra Costa lab was up and running. Government-funded crime labs experience all the usual economic vagaries one would expect. Elected officials know it's not popular to reduce the police force, so job cuts often fall on less conspicuous positions, like forensic scientists. Lab equipment isn't cheap, and lab directors often have to make repeated requests to get what they need. which in part explains why the Contra Costa lab, historically lean, needed about a year and a half to catch up with Orange County. In January 2001, when Contra Costa got its STR typing up and running, Holes asked one of his colleagues, Dave Stockwell, to rerun the DNA extracts from the ear case to see if the three cases still had the same offender profile. Stockwell reported back they did. "Call Mary Hong in Orange County," Holes told him. "We've got the same technology now. Check it against hers." Over the phone, Stockwell and Hong read off the markers to each other. "Yes," Hong said when Stockwell read one of the ear markers. "Yes," Stockwell said in reply to one of hers. Stockwell came into Holes's office. "Perfect match." The news hit the media on April 4th, 2001. "DNA links 70s rapes to serial slaying cases," read the San Francisco Chronicle headline. No one had warned the surviving rape victims that the story was coming out, so many of them got a shock picking up the morning paper at the breakfast table. There it was, on the front page of the Sacramento Bee. "New lead found in serial rapes. After decades, DNA links the East Area Rapist to crimes in Orange County." Even more unreal for many of them was the sight of the detectives on the front page of the Bee, Richard Shelby and Jim Bevins. Shelby, tall, gruff, coarse, the guy with the impeccable memory and miserable social skills whom fellow officers tried to keep from interacting with people. And Jim Bevins, "Puddin' Eyes," his cop buddies called him teasingly. No one was liked more than Bevins. Even when he was striding towards you from 50 yards away, you could see that he was the guy sent to de-escalate and make everything right. And here they were on the front page, old men now. 25 years is a long time in cop years. The high mileage showed. Their expressions hinted at something. Sheepishness? Shame? They speculated on what their nemesis was doing now. Shelby voted loony bin. Bevins guessed dead. Holes fielded reporters' calls and enjoyed the excitement for a few days. But even though privately he still felt investigative work was his calling, he'd been promoted to criminalist supervisor. Commitments beckoned. He was married with two young kids. He didn't have the time to dedicate himself to the 10,000 pages of case files that the new DNA connection unified. It was an unheard-of amount of evidence. Optimism among those who worked the case ran sky high. DNA profile? 60 cases spanning the state of California? They fought over who would interrogate him first when they got him in the room. Larry Poole in Orange County was the designated point man. For Poole, the news of the DNA connection was great but daunting, as if he'd spent the last couple of years in a small, familiar room, only to discover that it was an annex to a warehouse. He continued to bat away contempt from hardened cops who kept insisting that the monster was dead. Sexually motivated serial killers don't stop killing unless they're stopped. Maybe some righteous homeowner shot him dead during a burglary. "Don't waste your time," they said. 7 months later, Poole would be vindicated by some news from the Pacific Northwest. In November 2001, the media's attention turned to another unidentified serial killer who'd been dormant for nearly two decades and presumed by some to be long dead. Washington's Green River Killer. As it turned out, this prolific slayer of prostitutes was very much alive and well and living in suburban Seattle. His reason for slowing down? He'd gotten married. "Technology got me," Gary Ridgway told cops, the verbal equivalent of an upturned middle finger. He was right. He fooled the cops for years by slackening his face and dimming the light in his eyes. "No way this half-wit is a diabolical serial killer," they thought. And always, despite mounting evidence, they let him go. On April 6, 2001, 2 days after the news linking the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker hit the media, the phone rang in a house on Thornwood Drive in East Sacramento. A woman in her early 60s answered. She'd lived in the house for nearly 30 years, though her last name had changed. "Hello?" The voice was low. He spoke slowly. She recognized it immediately. "Remember when we played?" Part 2. Sacramento, 2012. Editor's note. The following section is an excerpt from an early draft of Michelle's article, In the Footsteps of a Killer, for Los Angeles Magazine. The woman who sat across from me in the cramped office at a troubled high school in East Sacramento was a stranger. But you wouldn't have known that from the conversational shorthand we used with each other from the moment we met. The Iran's version of Klingon. Dog-beating burglary in 74? I asked. The woman, I'll call her the social worker, retied her thick ponytail and took a sip from a can of Rockstar. She's almost 60, with large penetrating green eyes and a smoky voice. She greeted me in the parking lot by waving her arms wildly overhead. I liked her right away. I don't believe it's related, she said. The 74 burglary in Rancho Cordova is the kind of recently uncovered incident members of the board, that is, A&E's cold case files message board on Iran's, of which the social worker is one of the de facto leaders, thrive on analyzing. I've come to appreciate their thoroughness about the case, but at first I was simply daunted. There are over 1,000 topics and 20,000 posts. I found my way to the board about a year and a half ago after devouring, practically in one sitting, Larry Crompton's book, Sudden Terror, which is an unvarnished avalanche of case details, full of 1970s political incorrectness and strangely moving in its depiction of one matter-of-fact cop's haunting regret. The abundance of information available on the case astounded me. More than a dozen books are dedicated to December 25th, 1996, the night JonBenet Ramsey was murdered. But Iran's? Here was a case that spanned a decade, an entire state, changed DNA law in California, included 60 victims, a collection of strange utterances from the suspect at crime scenes, I'll kill you like I did some people in Bakersfield, a poem he allegedly wrote, Excitement's Crave, even his voice on tape, a brief, whispery taunt recorded by a device the police put on a victim's phone. Yet there was only a single, self-published, hard-to-find book written about it. This case inspired California Proposition 69, approved in 2004, which mandated DNA collection from all felons and from adults and juveniles charged with certain crimes, e.g. sex offenses, murder, arson. Keith Harrington's brother Bruce sponsored the campaign, pledging nearly $2 million to fund it. When I logged on to the Iran's board for the first time, I was immediately struck by the capable, exhaustive crowdsourcing being done there. Yes, cranks exist, including one well-meaning guy who insists that Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, is Iran's. He's not. But much of the analysis is first-rate. A frequent poster named Port of Leith, for instance, helped uncover the fact that California State University Sacramento's academic calendar from the years the ear was active there correlates with his crimes. There are member-made maps detailing everything from crime scene locations to witness sightings to the spot where he dropped a bloody motocross glove in Dana Point. Hundreds of posts dissect his possible connections to the military, real estate, and medicine. The Iran's sleuths have skills, and they're serious about using those skills to catch him. I met with a computer science graduate student at a Los Angeles Starbucks to discuss his person of interest. Before we met, I received a 7-page dossier, which included footnotes, maps, and yearbook photos of the suspect. I agreed that the suspect looked promising. One unknown detail that niggled at the grad student was his suspect's shoe size. At 9 or 9.5, the ear's shoe size is slightly smaller than the average man's. Message board members tend to be a paranoid bunch, pseudonym heavy, and perhaps unsurprisingly for people who spend a great deal of time on the internet discussing serial murder, there are personality conflicts. The social worker operates as a kind of gatekeeper between Sacramento investigators and the board community. This irks some posters, who accuse her of hinting at confidential information, but then shutting down when asked to share. That she occasionally has new information to share is not in dispute. On July 2, 2011, the social worker posted a drawing of a decal that she said was seen on a suspicious vehicle near the scene of one of the Sacramento rapes. It is possibly from NAS, Naval Air Station, North Island, but unconfirmed and has no record. Is it familiar to anyone on the board? hoping we may find where it is from. We. The curious but unmistakable presence of law enforcement became apparent the more I got sucked into the board. The web detectives, drawn to a decades-old cold case for their own private, idiosyncratic reasons, were the ones hunting the killer with their laptops. But the investigators were subtly steering them. The social worker took me on a driving tour of Eyre hotspots, around the maze of modest ranch houses abutting the old Mather Air Force Base, through the larger, leafier neighborhoods of Arden Arcade and Del Deo. She began working informally with Sacramento investigators about 5 years ago, she told me. I lived here through the height of it, she said. She was a young mom then, and remembers the terror reaching a nearly debilitating peak around rape number 15. The East Sacramento neighborhoods Irans preyed on were not built for excitement. I counted an entire block of unbroken beige. The tamped-down cautiousness belies the terrible things that happened here. We turned onto Malaga Way, where on August 29, 1976, the clanging of her wind chimes and the strong smell of aftershave awakened a 12-year-old girl. A masked man stood at her bedroom window, prying at the upper left corner of the screen with a knife. It's a really dark place, thinking about this stuff, the social worker said. So why did she? She'd been channel surfing one night in bed years ago when she came across the tail end of a Cold Case Files episode. She sat up in horrified recognition. Oh my God, she thought. He became a murderer. An uneasy memory from that period nagged her, and she reached out to a detective with the Sacramento Police Department to see whether it was all in her mind. It wasn't. He confirmed that before the Eyre's penchant for phoning victims had ever been publicized, she had filed 3 police reports about an obscene caller, a stalker who, she said, knew everything about me. She now believes the caller was Irons. The American River flashed blue in the distance. She feels spiritually called, the social worker told me, to help solve the case. But I've learned you've got to watch out, to take care of yourself, or it can consume you. Can? We'd spent the last 4 hours talking of nothing else but Irons. When her husband senses where she's headed at dinner parties, he kicks her under the table and whispers, "Don't start." I once spent an afternoon tracking down every detail I could about a member of the 1972 Rio Americano High School water polo team because in the yearbook photo he appeared lean and to have big calves, at one point a purported Irons trait. She once dined with a suspect and then bagged his water bottle for DNA. In the police files, suspects' names are often logged last name first, and at my lowest, most dazed point, I actually began looking into one Larry Berg, before my eyes and brain realigned to recognize burglary. There's a scream permanently lodged in my throat now. When my husband, trying not to awaken me, tiptoed into our bedroom one night, I leaped out of bed, grabbed my nightstand lamp, and swung it at his head. Luckily, I missed. When I saw the lamp overturned on the bedroom floor in the morning, I remembered what I'd done and winced. Then I felt around the covers for where I'd left my laptop, and resumed my Talmudic study of the police reports. However, I didn't laugh at the social worker's gentle warning about not becoming obsessed. I nodded. We're skirting a rabbit hole, I agreed to pretend, rather than deep inside it. Joining us inside the rabbit hole is a 30-year-old man from South Florida, whom I'll call the Kid. The Kid has a film degree, and, he's hinted, a somewhat troubled relationship with his family. Details matter to the Kid. He recently stopped watching a cable broadcast of Dirty Harry because it blew up from an aspect ratio of 2.35:1 to 1.78:1 after the opening credits. He's smart, meticulous, and occasionally brusque. He's also, in my opinion, the case's greatest amateur hope. Most people familiar with the Irons case agree that one of the best leads is his geographic trail. There are only so many white men born between, let's say, 1943 and 1959 who lived or worked in Sacramento, Santa Barbara County, and Orange County between 1976 and 1986. But only the Kid has spent nearly 4,000 hours data mining the possibilities, cold searching everything from Ancestry.com to USSearch.com. He owns, courtesy of eBay, a copy of the R.L. Polk 1977 Sacramento Suburban Directory. He has the 1983 Orange County Telephone Directory digitized on his hard drive. My first inkling that the kid's work was high quality came at the beginning of my interest in the case, when, after noting from his posts on the board that he seemed knowledgeable, I emailed him about a possible suspect I'd uncovered. I've now come to realize that getting excited about a suspect is a lot like that first surge of stupid love in a relationship, in which, despite vague alarm bells, you plow forward convinced that he is the one. I all but had my suspect in handcuffs, but the kid was about a year of researching and several databases ahead of me. "Haven't done anything with that name in a while," he wrote back. Included in the email was the image of a dour nerd in a sweater vest, my suspect's sophomore year picture. "Not in my top tier," wrote the kid. He later underscored how tricky suspect assessment is by pointing out that just based on geographic history and physical description, a good Iran suspect would be Tom Hanks, who, it should be emphasized, can be eliminated by the shooting schedule of bosom buddies alone. I was vacationing last spring in Florida with my family and made arrangements to meet the kid in person at a coffee shop. He's attractive, clean-cut with sandy brown hair, and articulate, an altogether unlikely candidate for compulsive data miner of cold cases he has no connection to. He declined coffee but chain-smoked Camel Lights. We talked for a bit about California and the movie business. He told me he once traveled to Los Angeles just to see the director's cut of his favorite film, Wim Wenders's Until the End of the World. Mostly, we discussed our common obsession. "The case is so complex and difficult to distill to people that I always find it something of a relief to be in the presence of someone who knows the shorthand." We both seemed a little mystified and self-conscious about our preoccupation. At a wedding reception recently, the groom interrupted a conversation between his mother and the kid, who is an old friend. "Tell her about your serial killer," the groom suggested to the kid before moving on. "What I always think about," I told him, "are experiments that show that animals in captivity would rather have to search for their food than have it given to them. Seeking is the lever that tips our dopamine gush. What I don't mention is the uneasy realization I've had about how much our frenetic searching mirrors the compulsive behavior, the trampled flower beds, scratch marks on window screens, crank calls, of the one we seek." Something Jeff Klepakis, a detective with the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department, said offhand finally made me feel less strange about my fascination. We were sitting in his and his partner's Iran's war room, a back office teeming with plastic bins stacked with old file folders. Over his right shoulder hung a poster-sized Google Earth map of Goleta with the sites of the double homicides marked, 19 months between them, but only 0.6 miles apart. The San Jose Creek curved down the middle of the map, its massive, draping trees providing Iran's with cover. I asked Klepakis what made him come out of retirement to work on the case. He shrugged. "I love puzzles," he said. The kid was getting at the same thing when he wrote a brief explanation for any investigators who might come across his research. His interest, he wrote using the third person, is inexplicable in short form, except to say that it's a big question with a simple answer, and he's compelled to know the answer. The kid eventually shared with me his pièce de résistance, which he calls The Master List, a 118-page document with some 2,000 men's names and their information, including dates of birth, address histories, criminal records, and even photos when available. His thoroughness, it has an index, left me agape. There are notations under some men's names, dedicated cycling advocate, and relative, Bonnie, that seem nonsensical unless you know, as we do, far too much about a possibly dead serial killer who was last active when Reagan was president. "At some point, I'll have to walk away from all this and move on with my life," the kid wrote me in an email. "The irony has been that the more time and money I invest into this very impractical, and to most inexplicable, endeavor, the more apt I am to continue doing so, so that I may perhaps identify this fucker and thus justify my investment." Not everyone admires the bored sleuths or their efforts. One agitator came on recently to rant about what he characterized as wannabe cops with a twisted, pathetic obsession. He accused them of being untrained meddlers with an unhealthy interest in rape and murder. Walter Mitty Detective, he wrote. By then, I was convinced one of the Mitties was probably going to solve this thing. East Sacramento, 2012. The things they see. Headlights in an empty field behind their house where a car shouldn't be. A man in a white shirt and dark pants climbing through a hole in a neighbor's fence at 3 a.m. Jimmied doors. A flashlight beam in their bedroom window. A man emerging from a drainage ditch and sneaking into the backyard next door. Gates previously closed, now open. A dark-haired man in a blue leisure suit standing under a tree across the street, staring at them. Mysterious footprints in the yard. A man bursting forth from the bushes and hopping on a bicycle. More flashlights and bedroom windows. The lower half of a man dressed in brown corduroys and tennis shoes running alongside the house and hiding behind a planter. A census worker at the front door wanting to know how many people live in the house in a year the census isn't being taken. Their neighbor, a 34-year-old man stumbling out of his house in his underwear, arms and legs bound, screaming for help at 2 in the morning. The things they hear. Dogs barking. Heavy footsteps on the lava rock path. Someone cutting through the window screen. A thump against the air conditioner. Tampering with the sliding glass door. Scratching at the side of the house. A call for help. A scuffle. Gunshots. A woman's long scream. No one calls the police. The police canvasses net these after-the-fact observations. Occasionally, when the police stop by neighbors' homes to ask questions, they're shown a slashed screen or vandalized porch light. Reading through the police reports, I found the neighbors' inaction peculiar at first. Eventually, I became borderline obsessed. Some of the unreported suspicious behavior occurred at the height of the East Area Rapist Panic in Sacramento. He was prowling these neighborhoods constantly. Why didn't more people call in? I asked Richard Shelby. At first glance, Shelby is rough-looking, as a retired cop in his mid-70s living out in the sticks of Placer County might be. We live so far out in the country we keep our gas in jerry cans, he told me. He's tall and wary. He's got a W.C. Fields nose, and of course he's missing half of his left ring finger, that injury that almost kept him off the force. But there's a softness there, in his light blue shirt, in his extremely soft voice I could barely hear. And in the way, when the waitress at lunch told him they were out of lemonade, he didn't scowl, but smiled softly and murmured, "Iced tea, then." Shelby, who had what he admits was a rocky career with the Sacramento Sheriff's Department, came on the case early, in fall 1976, and was among the first to make the connection that they had a serial rapist on their hands. "Call in what?" Shelby asked. "It's night. He's dressed all in black, creeping along the hedges." "What's to see?"
"I mean what came out during the police canvasses. What the neighbors full-on admitted they saw and heard," I said.
A line jotted down during a police canvas of the area around Malaga Road and El Caprice in Rancho Cordova on September 1, 1976, after the third rape, particularly haunted me. Several of the neighbors stated they heard the screaming, but did not look outside. In January 1977, a man who lived just south of the American River, and whose home had recently been burglarized, glimpsed a young guy peeping into his next-door neighbor's window. He coughed to let the peeper know he'd been spotted. The stranger ran. The gesture seemed almost polite. A week later, a 25-year-old woman living one block north became victim 11. She was 5 months pregnant at the time. Maybe the reluctance to call police was emblematic of the 70s, I suggested to Shelby. I started in on something about post-Vietnam rootlessness, but Shelby shook his head. He didn't have an answer, but that wasn't it. For him, the neighbor's passivity was just one failure in a case plagued with them, from superiors preoccupied with bullshit politics to a couple of crucial wrong turns Shelby admits he made in his own patrol car, to a dispatcher's instruction to a family calling about a cloth bag they'd found hidden in their hedges that contained a flashlight, ski mask, and gloves. Throw it away. Shelby lives about 30 miles north of Sacramento now, in the country, where he can do, as he put it, manly farmer things. But we'd met for lunch in his old stomping grounds, in the neighborhood where 36 years ago he patrolled the twisty streets buffeting the river,
his dashboard lights dimmed, directed only by radio sputter and the hope that he'd make the right turn and his headlight beams would land on a young man about 5'9" in a ski mask. Shelby never encountered another offender like the East Area rapist in his career. Up on rooftops, they kept finding small items he'd stolen from victims. For some reason, he was tossing them up there. Then, after enough people called in about strange thumps on their roofs, Shelby realized that the stolen items weren't being tossed, but were falling out of his pocket. He was crawling around up there. Shelby's one of those proudly blunt people whose eyes flick away the moment before they say something hard, a giveaway to softness churning underneath. He'd picked the lunch spot, but I could tell that for him this neighborhood would always be the place where he was thwarted by the stutter steps of an opponent, that sociopathic bastard whose voyeur's lair, indicated by a heap of cigarette butts and zigzag shoe tracks, he once found under a dense tree off Northwood Drive. Another vague presence noted by neighbors but never called in. "People say he was so smart," Shelby said. His eyes flicked away. "Truth is, he didn't always need to be." Early in my reporting for an Iran story I had pitched to Los Angeles Magazine, while in Sacramento, I came into possession of a flash drive containing over 4,000 pages of digitized old police reports. I acquired the flash drive in an old-fashioned trade, the kind in which neither party really trusts the other, and so, arms extended and eyes locked, we agreed to simultaneously release our goods for the other to grab. I had in my possession a rarely seen disc of a 2-hour videotaped interview with a peripheral but important person connected to one of the Southern California homicides. I gave it away without a second thought. I had a copy at home. These underground trades, the result of furtive alliances forged from a shared obsession with a faceless serial killer, were common. Online sleuthers, retired detectives, and active detectives, everyone participated. I received more than one email with the subject line, quid pro quo. I believed, as they did, that I and I alone was going to spot what no one else could see. In order to do that, I needed to see everything. The grandiose seeker in me couldn't wait to insert the flash drive into my laptop back at my hotel. At every stoplight, I touched the top pocket in my backpack to make sure the tiny rectangle was still there. I was staying at the Citizen Hotel on J Street downtown. The photos online, of lead-paned windows and mustard-colored striped wallpaper, had appealed to me. The check-in area had built-in bookshelves for walls. The front desk was ornate and painted Chinese red. "How would you describe the style here?" I asked the front desk clerk when I was checking in. "Law library meets bordello," he said. I later learned that the building's architect, George Sellin, had also designed San Quentin. Once in my room, I immediately changed into the crisp white hotel bathrobe. I lowered the shades and turned off my phone. I dumped a bag of mini-bar gummy bears into a glass and set it next to me on the bed, where I sat cross-legged in front of my laptop. Ahead of me was a rare 24-hour stretch without interference or distraction. No tiny hands slick with paint asking to be washed, no preoccupied hungry husband appearing in the kitchen to inquire about dinner. I inserted the flash drive, my mind in mail sorter mode, my index finger on the down arrow key. I began to not so much read as devour. Police reports read like stories told by robots. They're terse and demarcated, with little space for judgment or emotion. Initially, the sparseness appealed to me. Scrubbed of extraneous detail, I felt sure his name would gleam. I misjudged. The concise format of the reports is deceiving. Absorbed cumulatively, even the most clipped details began to swarm into an indistinguishable mass. Some moments separated from the pack, imparting jolts of powerful feeling I didn't always see coming. The recently separated 38-year-old mother who scoots across the floor in the dark to find her son's toy saw and tries in vain to use it to cut the bindings from her swollen hands. The 13-year-old girl tied up in bed who asks her beloved dog after the rapist has left the room, "You dummy, why didn't you do anything?" The dog nudges her with his nose. She tells him to lie down and go to sleep. He does. Hours vanished. The gummy bears were gone. My room was on the 10th floor, right above a tent hosting a wedding reception. I'd sidestepped the bridesmaids in seafoam green posing for pictures in the hallway on my way in, and now the music started up. It was loud. I picked up the phone to call the front desk. What was I going to say? Keep the joy down? I hung up. The truth was I was jittery from sugar, hunger, and spending too much time alone in the dark absorbing a 50-chapter horror story narrated in the kind of dead voice used by desk clerks at the DMV. My eyes were stripped by computer glare and as devoid of moisture as if they'd been vacuumed clean by an airplane toilet. Kool and the Gang's Celebration wasn't the soundtrack for my frame of mind. The city of Sacramento is located at the north end of California's Central Valley, at the confluence of the Sacramento River and the American River, and was designed with drainage in mind. The idea is that excess water, from mountain runoff or rainfall, will flow downriver toward the California Delta and into the ocean. I know this only because drainage ditches and cement-lined canals come up frequently in the police reports. It's clear from the start, from footprints, evidence, suspicious sightings, and even bringing one victim down there, that the East Area rapist traveled this way. That like a subterranean creature, he bided his time below ground until dark. I was reminded of an iconic scene from The Creature from the Black Lagoon, when the marine biologist Kay, played by the beautiful actress Julie Adams, dives from the expedition ship into the Black Lagoon. And from an underwater point of view, we watch as the terrifying humanoid creature emerges from a tangle of seaweed to glide underneath her, mirroring her, mesmerized. You keep waiting for her to see him and thrash with panic, but he goes undetected, except for the moment when he brushes a scaly webbed claw against her foot, and she jerks a little, unnerved. The East Area rapist stalked individuals, but it was clear after reading the police reports that he stalked neighborhoods too, often by traversing Sacramento's underground maze of canals and drainage ditches. He preferred single-story houses, usually second from the corner, near a greenbelt area. An open field. A park. Before an attack, there'd be evidence of prowling and illegal entries in the homes around the victims. Small, inexpensive, sometimes personal items would go missing. Incidents of hang-up phone calls rose sharply in the 4 or 5 block radius just before an attack. He was doing reconnaissance. He was studying people, learning when they were home. His method appeared to be to pick a neighborhood, target a half-dozen possible victims, and maybe even prioritize them. He maximized options and laid groundwork. That way, when mission night arrived, his urge never went unfulfilled. That means that women exist who, because of change of schedule or luck, were never victims. But like the creature's shapely object of obsession treading in the lagoon, they felt something terrifying brush against them. The neighbors, in the scant 5 or 6 lines allotted them in the canvas reports, offer evocative haikus of a certain time and place. When questioned, they're on their way back from the disco club, or a double feature of Earthquake and Airport 77 at the drive-in, or the Jack LaLanne gym. They report missing 2 size 5 women's jackets, one brown suede, the other leather. A girl saw a suspicious man with a Wolfman Jack look. Door-to-door solicitors, sprinklers, fuller brush, personal photography, painters, were a near constant presence back then. In one neighborhood, everyone seemed to be heading for work at 5 a.m. These people took special notice of newer model, shiny cars. In other neighborhoods, mostly north of the American River, the only person home to answer the officer's questions might be the live-in babysitter. These neighbors were suspicious of dirty cars, cars with side dents that were a heap or in bad shape. In April 1977, a boy hoisted his younger sister onto his shoulders. From her higher vantage point, she suddenly saw a prowler in her neighbor's yard, a white man in dark clothing crouching in the bushes. When the prowler realized he'd been spotted, he took off running and hurdled several fences. A month later, that neighbor, a young waitress, woke her husband at 4 a.m. "I hear something. I hear something," she said. A flashlight lit up their bedroom doorway. She later told police that she believed the ear when he threatened to kill her, and she lay there, bound in the dark, wondering what it would feel like to have a bullet go through her. Reading through the Sacramento reports, you can track public awareness that there's a serial rapist at large. It's zero to dim in the first dozen or so attacks. Then the media runs with the story, and chatter and paranoia build. By a year into the attacks, victims recount being awakened by flashlight and thinking, "Oh shit, it's him." They behaved in certain ways, they told investigators, based on gossip they'd heard about the East Area rapist. Cowering, for instance, because they'd been told he liked his victims terrified. It's around a year in that the source of neighbors' inaction is no longer unawareness or inertia, but a fortress mentality. They see something, and they lock their doors, turn off the lights, and retreat to their bedroom, hoping he doesn't come for them. "I was afraid," one woman admitted. "Then why not call the police?" My imagination burbled with what-ifs. They weren't thinking of their neighbors, but he was. Part of the thrill of the game for him, I believe, was a kind of connect-the-dots puzzle he played with people. He stole 2 packs of Winston cigarettes from the first victim, for instance, and left them outside the fourth victim's house. Junk jewelry stolen from a neighbor 2 weeks earlier was left at the fifth victim's house. Victim 21 lived within shouting distance of a water treatment plant. A worker there who lived 8 miles away became the next victim. Pills or bullets stolen from a victim would later be found in a neighbor's yard. Some victims shared surnames or jobs. It was a power play, a signal of ubiquity. I am both nowhere and everywhere. You may not think you have something in common with your neighbor, but you do. Me. I'm the barely spotted presence, the dark-haired, blonde-haired, stocky, slight, seen from the back, glimpsed in half-light thread, that will continue to connect you even as you fail to look out for each other. I left Sacramento in a bad mood. I hadn't slept well. The hungover wedding party crowded the front door of the hotel as I tried to make my way out. At the airport, I walked past a giant red rabbit sculpture I somehow had been too preoccupied to notice when I flew in. I don't know how I missed it before. The 56-foot-long, 10,000-pound aluminum rabbit is suspended by cables and appears to be diving toward the baggage claim area. I searched the term SAC Airport Rabbit on my iPhone while waiting to board my plane. An Associated Press article said that artist Lawrence Argent had been commissioned to create an iconic piece for the new terminal, which was unveiled in October 2011. I wanted to play around with the idea that something has come from the outside and leapt into the building, Argent said. The Cufflinks Coda. Editor's note. The following section is an excerpt from an early draft of Michelle's article, In the Footsteps of a Killer, for Los Angeles Magazine. The day after I placed the order for the cufflinks, I called the kid. I told him I was having the cufflinks shipped overnight to me. To a P.O. box? The kid asked. Well, no, I admitted. A ludicrous scenario flashed through my mind. Eron's reselling the cufflinks to the store where he happened to work, inputting customer addresses. He'd no doubt be suspicious of someone who paid $40 for next-day delivery of his $8 cufflinks. The best thing to do, I knew, was to turn over the cufflinks to Eron's investigators. The risk was that they'd be angry I'd taken this kind of unauthorized initiative. Coincidentally, I had recently scheduled my very first interview with Larry Poole in Orange County. I decided that if I felt the interview was going well, I'd explain the story and hand over the tiny gold cufflinks in their square Ziploc bag. The problem was, of all the investigators, the prospect of meeting with Poole was the most intimidating to me. He'd been described as inaccessible and a little remote. I knew he'd been working on the case for the last 14 years. He'd been instrumental, along with victim Keith Harrington's attorney brother Bruce, in the passage of Proposition 69. The DNA Fingerprint Unsolved Crime and Innocence Protection Act, which in 2004 established an all-felon DNA database in California. The California Department of Justice now has the largest working DNA databank in the country. Poole and Harrington felt that by expanding the DNA database, they'd surely net Eron's. The disappointment when that didn't happen, it was suggested to me, was sharp. I had imagined Larry Poole as a steely, impassive cop locked away in a dimly lit room, the walls plastered with Eron's composites. A pleasant but somewhat formal man in wire-rimmed glasses and a red checkered shirt greeted me in the lobby of the Orange County Regional Computer Forensics Laboratory. We sat in a conference room. He was duty officer for the computer lab that day, and when the occasional colleague poked their head in and said something, Poole would respond with a clipped, "Copy that." I found him a thoughtful, measured speaker, the kind of person whose stoic exterior masks how generous they're being with their insights. When I met with Larry Crompton, it was clear that the retired detective took his failure to solve the case personally. It kept him up at night, Crompton confessed, and he always asked himself, "What did I miss?" Poole didn't present the same sort of anguish. At first I took this as cockiness. Later I realized it was hope. He's not nearly done yet. We were wrapping up our conversation. I pegged him as someone who prioritizes procedure and decided he wouldn't like the cufflink story. But at the very end, I caved. I don't know why. I began speaking way too fast and rustling around in my backpack. Poole listened, but his face revealed nothing. I nudged the cufflinks across the conference table at him. He took the bag and examined it very carefully. "For me?" he asked, stone-faced. "Yes," I said. He allowed the slightest hint of a smile. "I think I love you," he said. By the time I returned home to Los Angeles, Poole had tracked down the victims and sent them a high-resolution image of the cufflinks by email. The cufflinks had originally belonged to a deceased family member, and the victims had had them in their possession only a short while before they were stolen. They looked like the cufflinks, but the victims were cautious about merely wanting them to be them. They got in touch with another family member who was more familiar with the jewelry. A couple of days later, Poole called me with the news. Not the same cufflinks. I was disappointed. Poole seemed unfazed. "I don't get excited like I used to," he'd told me earlier. A decade ago, when the shock of the DNA match between the ear and the ons was still fresh, he had every investigative resource at his disposal. An Orange County Sheriff's Department helicopter once flew to Santa Barbara just to pick up a suspect's DNA swab. The suspect was under active surveillance at the time. Poole traveled to Baltimore to exhume a body. This was before 9/11, and he recalls that parts of the suspect were packed in his carry-on. Eventually, cold case funding dried up. Investigators got reassigned. And Poole got less emotionally invested in every new development. Even the composite of earons that hangs above Poole's desk is deliberate and matter-of-fact. It shows the suspect in a ski mask. "Is it of any value?" Poole said. "No. But we know he looked like that." He showed me the stack of mail he continues to get with tips from the public, including one piece of paper with a photocopy of a man's driver's license photo and the words, "This is Eron's." The man is far too young to be a viable suspect. 8,000 suspects have been examined over the years, Poole estimates. Several hundred have had their DNA run. They conducted a DNA test on one suspect in a southern state twice when they weren't satisfied with the quality of retrieval the first time. When Poole comes across an especially intriguing suspect, his curt response is always the same. "Gotta eliminate him." Despite his reserve, Poole has reason to be optimistic about the case. In fact, everyone who's weathered the ups and downs of the Eron's mystery agrees that the pendulum is currently swinging in an upward direction. Los Angeles, 2012. I was in a panic. We were hosting, as we had for years, about a dozen adults and four kids under the age of 10, and the second draft of my 7,000-word story was due Tuesday. A few days before, I'd sent out SOS emails, brief and frank pleas for help that I hoped would be understood. Dinner rolls. Butter. Thanksgiving always makes me nostalgic for the Midwest. But the day was sunny and unusually brisk, the kind of California autumn afternoon when, if you concentrate on your friend's gray cardigan and the forkful of pumpkin pie in your mouth and the snippet of NFL commentary running in the background, you can forget the bougainvillea and the wet swimsuits drying over the backyard chairs. You can imagine that you live somewhere where the seasons actually change. I wasn't myself, though. Impatience roiled. I made a bigger deal than I needed to that Patton bought an undersized turkey. When we went around the table and said what we were thankful for, I forgot the holiday for a moment and shut my eyes, thinking about a wish. After dinner, the kids piled together on the couch and watched The Wizard of Oz. I stayed out of the room. Little kids have big emotions, and mine needed reining in. That Saturday, Patton took Alice for the day, and I hunkered down in my office on the second floor to revise and write. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the front doorbell rang. We get a lot of deliveries, and I had, in fact, already answered the door a couple of times that day and signed for packages. I was irritated at yet another interruption. Normally, I'd ignore it and let them leave the package at the door. Usually, just to be sure, I walk over to our bedroom window and peek out. And yes, there's the brown back of the FedEx delivery man, our front gate closing behind him. I'm not sure what made me get up this time, but I walked a few steps down our curving staircase and called out, "Who is it?" No one replied. I went to our bedroom window and peeked out. A slim, young African-American kid in a pink shirt and tie was walking away from our house. I had the strong sense he was a teenager. Maybe I saw him in profile for a moment. I guessed he was selling magazine subscriptions door to door and let the drape fall. I went back to work and didn't think more about it. About 45 minutes later, I got up and grabbed my car keys. I'd made plans to meet Patton and Alice for an early dinner at one of our favorite restaurants in the neighborhood. I made sure the doors were locked and headed out to my car parked on the street. When I was about halfway down our walk, I saw out of the corner of my eye the figure of a young man off to my left, walking very slowly with his back to me in front of my next-door neighbor's house. I'm not sure I would have noted him if his body language hadn't been so unusual. He froze completely when I came bounding out of the house. He was a young African-American kid, not the same kid who'd rung our door, but similarly dressed in a pastel blue shirt and tie. He kept his body still and craned his neck ever so slightly in my direction. I hesitated. I thought again about teenagers selling magazine subscriptions, and wondered if he was gauging me as a possible customer. But I knew it was weirder than that. His body language was so off. I got into my car and drove away, and as I did, I picked up my phone to call the police. I pressed 9 and 1. But what was I going to say? Suspicious young black kid? That felt racist and like an overreaction. I canceled the call. They weren't doing anything overtly criminal. Still, I hit the brakes and yanked the wheel to the left, making a quick U-turn back to our house. It couldn't have been more than 45 seconds, but neither kid was on the street. Dusk was making it harder to see. I figured they'd rung someone's bell, begun the magazine pitch, and been invited in. I headed to the restaurant. The following night, I was upstairs when I heard the doorbell ring and Patton greet someone at the front door. "Michelle!" he called. I came down. Our next-door neighbor, Tony, was standing there. Tony was the first neighbor we'd met when we'd bought our house 2.5 years earlier. We hadn't moved in yet, and I was at the house with our contractor, talking about renovations, when an attractive man in his 40s peeked in at the front door and introduced himself. My memory is that he was gregarious and a little self-effacing. The previous owner had been a recluse, and Tony had never seen the inside of the house. He was curious. I told him, "Go ahead, walk around." I thought from his outgoing demeanor that we'd end up being friends, the way you imagine things when you're picturing your life in a new space. He told me he was recently divorced, and his teenage daughter was going to live with him and attend the local all-girls Catholic high school. He was renting the house next door. But our relationship, while always friendly, never blossomed into a real friendship. We waved and made occasional small talk. When we first moved in, Patton and I talked about how we should have a get-together in our backyard and meet all the neighbors. Our intentions were good. We kept talking about it, but then getting waylaid. The house was always being worked on, or one of us was traveling. But when Alice's ball flew over the fence into their yard, Tony and his daughter always graciously returned it. When I found a motherless baby pigeon on the curb in front of their house and fashioned a nest from a wicker basket and leaves and fastened it to a tree branch, Tony came out and smiled at me. "You're a good person," he said. I liked him, but our interactions were relegated to comings and goings, to moments between dog walking and toddler wrangling. My second-floor office faces their house. A distance of only about 15 feet separates us. I've become accustomed to the rhythms of their lives. In the late afternoons, I hear their front door slam, and Tony's daughter, who has a beautiful voice, begins to sing. I always mean to tell her what a beautiful voice she has. I always forget. Tony was at our front door because he wanted to tell us that they'd been robbed yesterday. I think I know what happened, I said, and motioned for him to sit down on our living room couch. I explained the doorbell and no answer, and what I saw. He nodded. The elderly couple that lived on the other side of Tony had seen the same kids hauling bags out of Tony's house. They got in through the kitchen window and completely ransacked the place. The cops told him it's a common ruse used by teams of petty thieves on holiday weekends. Ring and see if anyone's home. If no one answers, break in. It's just iPads and computers, Tony said. But I keep thinking, what if my daughter had been home alone? What might have happened then? At the word daughter, his voice quavered. His eyes welled. So did mine. You don't have to explain, I said. It's such a violation. I reached out and put my hand on his. Michelle's a crime writer, Patton said. Tony looked surprised. I don't even know what you do, he said. From now on, the three of us told each other, we'll look out for each other. We'd alert each other when we were going out of town. We'd be better neighbors, we promised. Later that night, I kept going over the events of the last few days in my head. I thought about the intimacy of that moment in the living room, the unexpected surge of emotion we shared with Tony. We don't even know his last name, I said to Patton. I have a nightly ritual with Alice, who is a troubled sleeper and has terrifying dreams. Every night before falling asleep, she'll call out for me to come into her bedroom. I don't want to have a dream, she says. I brush her sandy hair back, put my hand on her forehead, and look straight into her big brown eyes. You are not going to have a dream, I tell her with crisp, confident enunciation. Her body releases its tension, and she goes to sleep. I leave the room, hoping that what I promised but have no control over will be true. That's what we do, all of us. We make well-intentioned promises of protection we can't always keep. I'll look out for you. But then you hear a scream, and you decide it's some teenagers playing around. A young man jumping a fence is taking a shortcut. The gunshot at 3 a.m. is a firecracker, or a car backfiring. You sit up in bed for a startled moment. Awaiting you is the cold, hard floor and a conversation that may lead nowhere. You collapse onto your warm pillow and turn back to sleep. Sirens wake you later. I saw Tony walking his big white dog this afternoon and waved at him from outside my car, in between fumbling for my keys and remembering something I had to do. I still don't know his last name. Contra Costa, 2013. Concord. The history of Concord, California involves Satan and a series of misunderstandings. Legend has it that in 1805, Spanish soldiers, in pursuit of a band of reluctantly missionized Native Americans, cornered their quarry near a willow thicket in what is present-day Concord. The natives took cover in the dense trees, but when the soldiers charged in to seize them, the natives were gone. The spooked Spaniards dubbed the area Monte del Diablo, Thicket of the Devil. The archaic definition of the word monte, translating loosely into woods. Over the years, it morphed into the more conventional mountain, or mount, and English-speaking newcomers transferred the name to the nearby 3,848-foot peak that dominates the East Bay landscape, and it became Mount Diablo, Devil Mountain. In 2009, a local man named Arthur Mijares filed federal paperwork to try to change the name to Mount Reagan. He found the devil name offensive. I just happen to be an ordinary man that worships God, he told the Los Angeles Times. Mijares wasn't successful, but he needn't have worried. Concord is 31 miles east of San Francisco and feels every mile of it. Whatever sinister wilderness existed has been bulldozed and replaced with enthusiastically bland retail hubs. Across from my hotel is the Willows Shopping Center, a sprawl of worrisomely underattended chain stores and restaurants, Old Navy, Pier 1 Imports, and Fuddruckers. Nearly everyone I ask about Concord mentions the convenience of its BART stop, East Bay's subway system. 20 minutes to Berkeley, they say. Paul Holes and I have agreed that he'll pick me up outside my hotel at 9 a.m. He's taking me on a tour of the Contra Costa County crime scenes. By morning, the temperature is already in the 80s, a blazing day in what will be the hottest month of the year in the East Bay. A silver Taurus pulls up right on time, and a fit, neatly